Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing X, which is Ty West's first horror film in 9 years and first film of any kind in six, I think.
I haven't seen his Western, so I can't speak to that. It was some time ago.
Yeah, 2016, I think. But last horror film was The Sacrament, mm-hmm. Right? That was
yes.
him?
Yeah, that was definitely him.
Yeah, the Jonestown adjacent.
Jonestown Jr.
Yeah, Jonestown Jr. 2013. I think I can safely say that Matt and I are both Ty West fans. He's done some good stuff. House of the Devil, probably the standout
to date. He definitely secured Matt Gerandese as a stan the day I watched that one. It's pretty excellent.
And indeed, he goes back to his
70s homage roots.
With X. It's a film about six? There's six of them. There's six generally attractive people. Well, maybe five and then one nerd who drive out into bumfuck nowhere, Texas to shoot
to
a porno.
To fuck some bums. not in the...
Bums in the bottoms
not
sense.
Not in the unhoused person's sense.
Yeah, so they're shooting a porno, hence X, presumably as in X-rated, and the homestead on which they're shooting this picture.
Their surreptitious porno opus
is owned and inhabited by two incredibly old people.
Yeah, elderly lunatics.
And it goes poorly for them, as you might expect.
Yeah. We open in Texas in 1979, the morning after a bloodbath. We got sheriff and his deputy scoping out the aforementioned homestead. There's bodies here and there, blood on the walls, on the floor. There's a TV on. Some local preacher man is prattling on about Old Testament type stuff. Sheriff goes into the basement, sees something horrific. What? We don't know. We don't lay eyes on it. But whatever it is, it elicits the obligatory, "Oh my God.
Mother of God."
Oh, and this is the very first line is the equally obligatory, "Sheriff, you're going to want to come and take a look at this." Right away, you know exactly where you are.
Well, shit, when the opening shot of the film, it's like through a barn door of the homestead. I'm like, oh, it's just the homestead from Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
The good one.
Right.
Not the one we did two episodes ago.
It does very much look like Chateau Leatherface. And that opening shot is nice, too, framed through the barn door because it creates a boxy aspect ratio. I was initially tricked into thinking that the whole movie was going to have kind of a squarish presentation like that, which is fitting because the porno they're shooting is all through the movie. You're juxtaposing porno elements, the film within the film, with the actual goings-on on the farm. So you're switching aspect ratios back and forth, so the opening shot kind of gets to have it both ways, with the camera beginning in the barn in the dark and then pushing through and the frame expands. So that was rather nice. Back in the basement, mother of God, the music kicks in, and you know, it's your standard kind of like, It's a little left of center, actually. It's not quite as cliched as I'm making it sound, but it's so obtrusive that I kept thinking about that old Eddie Izzard bit where all horror movies have the same soundtrack and it's a choir of children going, "I died tragically." That kept running through my head the whole time I was watching this, basically anytime the score kicked into high gear. So we cut to 24 hours previous. For a minute, for a period of some seconds, the spooky keeps going unabated, even though we've cut to what we find is the dressing room of a strip club, and where a woman performer is cutting up a line of coke and snorting it through a $10 bill. But we don't get the immediate classic rock needle drop that we're expecting. It comes belatedly, but the music persists in a way that I kind of appreciated. Most movies like this, the moment you jump 24 hours into the past, you would have right away gotten the 38 special or whatever the fuck. Right? Is that the name of the Hold On Loosely? I think
that's 38 special. You got it.
I don't remember what's playing in the dressing room, but shortly we get Mungo Jerry in the summertime, and then we're off to the races. But before that happens, the woman's, and I don't remember any of their names, the woman who's doing lines in the dressing room of the strip joint. All through the movie, there's this recurring motif where she gives herself these kind of, she looks into the mirror and tells herself these coked out affirmations about Dirk Diggler shit, about what a big star she's going to be. And her pimp manager boyfriend, this very McConaughey-esque character, comes into the dressing room and gives her a pep talk, you know, you're due on stage. And then afterwards, they step out into the bright Texas sunshine. We get the Mungo Jerry. We're introduced to the rest of the crew. There's the cameraman and I guess the nominal director of the porno picture, although he doesn't have very much clout.
No.
They override his creative decisions at every turn, which is pretty funny. Then you've got his girlfriend, who's operating the boom mic. And then you've got the three stars, the woman we met already, another woman, blonde woman, and the main star of the, well, the main male talent.
Yeah, I believe the cokehead's name is Maxine. And I used to know what the blonde's name is, and now I don't remember. But anyway, she and Maxine, I believe, are both supposed to be strippers at the club that they're exiting. Yeah, so we have our merry band together, and they all hop into their chariot, which is a van that is labeled Plowing Service, which is, of course, haha.
Yes, quite droll. So the producer, who I think owns the titty bar, has presumably pitched them on this idea of becoming porno millionaires in the burgeoning home video market. And he's like a classic hustler type, you know, sort of deluded. He delivers a variation on one of my favorite like failed businessman rationalizations, which is like, this market is worth X number of millions of dollars. If we can just get 1%, he says, if we can just make half of what Debbie Dallas made, Debbie Does Dallas, then we'll have it made. It's like,
Well, yeah, and there's the other one that's like, somebody asks him about, yeah, whatever happened with the topless car wash? He said, well, that would have worked if the IRS hadn't had it out for me.
Yeah, right.
You know, so it's...
And then meanwhile, you've got the director cameraman who has delusions of grandeur of a different flavor, which is that
artistic.
Which is that he delusions. Thinks he's Francois Truffaut. But his camera work isn't even that inspired in terms of, you know, a classic porno sensibility. One of the female talents has to tell him how to frame a shot when the main male actor is gassing up their van. She says, you should frame it from below such and such a way so that it looks like the gas nozzle is his cock. You know, it's like, yeah, that's obviously between this and a licorice pizza. That's having something of a renaissance right now. It's really entered the zeitgeist in a big way. Let's see. They stop at a gas station. Nothing much of consequence. The gas station TV is playing the same preacher from the prologue, and he recurs throughout the movie. The boom mic girl has Final Girl written all over her. She's like Laurie Strode in Halloween. She's a little mousier, sort of serious and quiet, more studious, maybe. She's comparatively virginal, I would say. Relatively chaste, you know, although admittedly the other two women are actual sex workers.
Okay, just to simplify all this, I've pulled this up so I can give you all the names.
Please.
Yeah, so as I said, the first girl's name is Maxine, the one with the coke and the coke affirmations.
Yeah, she's got freckles around one of her eyes, which is a prominent feature.
Yeah. That's
how I kept them straight, or, you know, one of the ways in which I kept them straight.
Yeah, the director's girlfriend is named Lorraine. The other stripper is named Bobby Lynn. The male talent, his name is Jackson. The producer's name is Wayne. And the director's name is RJ.
RJ, yes, I remember that.
So we'll see if we keep that all straight, but hopefully we can, so it'll be simpler.
So they arrive at the farm. Wayne is met by a cranky old coot at gunpoint. The guy trains a shotgun on him.
Are you here from the government?
You're from the county?
Right. No, I'm Wayne. We spoke on the phone, so they hash out the terms of their stay. Wayne has smuggled in way more nubile young people than the property owner was expecting, and he suspects that they're getting up to stuff he wouldn't approve of, although presumably he doesn't know they're shooting a porno movie. In fact, Lorraine even says as much, the sound girl.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what we're doing here. So they get down to business. After the negotiations are concluded, they shoot their first scene. Maxine starts wandering around. She goes for a swim in this swampy sort of lake, and she almost gets got by a crocodile, which she fails to even detect. And again, we get the, it's actually less like a satanic choir than I'm making it out to be. A lot of it is just kind of spooky exhalations. Like,
well, there's, I don't know if you picked up on this, but it seemed to me like there was a kind of like porno.
Yeah, well, they sound like amorous sighs much of
like,
the time.
Like very quiet.
Yes.
You know, but nevertheless, yeah, that's in there.
So she makes it out of harm's way without ever having realized that she even was in harm's way. It's a pretty close call. When the crocodile is introduced, or the alligator, whatever the hell it is, when we first lay eyes on it, it sort of lays eyes on us as well and does a creepy reptilian, like, sideways wink right at the camera, like we're complicit in what it's about to do. It's like an alligator funny games. Like he's breaking the fourth wall. It's really funny. After her dip in the pond, Maxine goes into Chateau Leatherface, and if the Texas Chainsaw Massacre parallels hadn't struck you before now, they definitely would here, because it's framed exactly like the first kill in the original TCM, where, you know, hello? And he like comes through the door. You expect Leatherface to round the corner and brain her with a meat mallet, just tenderize her, which does not happen. Instead, she bumps into the farmer's wife,
The farmer's wife beckoned her over.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Very spookily, sort of silently, slowly waving.
Yeah, and prior to that, we'd glimpsed her once before in a second-story window.
Yeah.
Once again, gazing out eerily.
And I'd just like to point out that the farmer and his wife are the two oldest people I have ever seen.
Yeah, so at first she seems just completely senile.
Like somehow older than Granddad or whatever the fuck his name is in Texas Chainsaw, one who's literally basically a corpse.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they look older than him, and yet they're more industrious, or more, we'll say, they've retained their competence in a way that he has not in his dotage. So she initially seems just totally out to lunch, not all there. And then she's revealed to still be fairly with it. She starts regaling Maxine, you know, about her past and about, I used to be beautiful once.
Like you.
And talks about how her husband served in both world wars. And she starts sort of caressing Maxine, and Maxine shrinks back. And this is all intercut with them shooting a porno scene back in the guest house or whatever it is. And it's a dialogue scene. It's all to do with porno foreplay. The farmer's daughter, it's the name of the movie they're shooting. The
farmer's
daughters, plural, yes. One of the titular daughters is talking about how, oh, you come with me to the bedroom before daddy gets home. Hitting on the milkman or whoever the hell. And played by the guy
with his car broke down.
Yeah, played by what's his name?
Jackson.
And it's intercut in such a way that it creates this suspense, all this talk about, you know, what happens if daddy catches us. It makes you fear the patriarch, you know, the war veteran, the double world war veteran coming back, even though he is this doddering old, half-dead septuagenarian, if not older.
Yeah, easily octogenarian. I mean, think about the fact that he served in the First World War and it's 1979.
Yeah,
he has
right.
to be in his 80s. It's required.
Yeah, right, you are. Just through this cross-cutting, it creates fear at the prospect of Glass Bones McGee coming through the door, which is rather neat. You know, granted, the first time we see him, he's waving a shotgun around, so he could kick some ass if he had to, even if he's not physically formidable, or at least does not yet appear to be. So Maxine sneaks out just as he's coming home, and it's another close call. So let's see. The film crew is wrapping up after a hard day's work, you know, celebrating, drinking beer and some pretty gross-looking sandwiches. Was that like a log of spam that he was carving up?
Well, or... spam doesn't come in logs.
Well, maybe it did in the 70s. I don't know.
I think it always came in a can.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
I don't know. Bologna. Yeah. Something.
And they get into a little bit of a back and forth about, I get the ethics of their line of work. The sound girl, you know, the mousy one, the one with final girl vibes.
Lorraine.
Lorraine. Thank you. Is asking them, well, isn't it cheating? No, it's different when there's a camera, says the director, who's about to eat those words in a big way. it's all just make-believe, honey. You know, he's a little bit patronizing towards her. It's just a movie, which sort of echoes Last House on the Left, you know, the marketing campaign. Just keep repeating to yourself, it's only a movie, which fits with the 70s slasher ethos here. Jackson breaks out his guitar and plays Landslide by Fleetwood Mac.
Bobby Lynn does the vocal.
Mm-hmm. And this is also intercut with the Maniac House, Chateau Leatherface, but in a way that's not supposed to create suspense, but rather, I assume, pathos. This whole sequence, I have to say, struck me as like the kind of artsy-fartsy idea that the director character in the movie would have that the rest of the crew would then shoot down. You know, he's always talking about how he wants to make it more avant-garde.
And shortly after he first says that, we get the first and certainly not the last instance of this quirky little scene transition that Ty West keeps doing, where he cuts to the next scene but then quick cuts back and then cuts over quick. It does it like three or four times.
Yeah.
It's sort of a blinking transition, if you will.
Yeah, I didn't dislike that. If it sort of recalled, it almost reminded me of someone chopping up a line of coke. It had that kind of staccato thing to it. I don't think he debuts it when you cut 24 hours earlier and you first meet Maxine.
No.
Doing lines, but no. For whatever reason, it evoked that for me. But this sequence, rather than being cut up in that manner, is all done split screen, and I could just imagine fucking RJ going like, oh, well, it's gonna be like De Palma.
Have you seen Carrie?
Have you seen Carrie? Mind-blowing, man. So it's the lady, the old lady, back in her own home, trying to get dolled up and looking sort of downbeat and pitiful, this Norma Desmond to the nth degree kind of thing, where she's not what she used to be, all set to the Fleetwood Mac cover. And then once the song is concluded, Lorraine breaks the silence by saying that she wants to be in the movie, which is a real mic drop moment for everybody else. There's like a bunch of cuts of like everyone's head turning.
Ooh.
One after another. And no one is more surprised than RJ, who I reiterate is dating the boom girl, Lorraine, and he's having none of it. But Wade pulls him aside and talks Wayne. Him into it. Right. No doubt seeing dollar signs, but he frames it as life advice, you know, mano y mano.
Right, yeah.
She's going to do it no matter what.
And if you push back, then she's just going to fuck everybody in the world, basically.
It's twice over.
Basically what he fucking tells her. If you don't let her be in this porno, she's going to bang everyone you know, including your dad.
So, especially your dad.
Your dad, in front of you.
I just had an idea for my next picture.
So, she doesn't bang everyone in the world, including RJ's dad. She only bangs Jackson in the following scene. But that's bad enough, apparently. RJ goes and has himself a good cry about it in the shower, looking very distraught. He hunkers down in the tub, and he's shot from above in such a way that he looks like Jennifer Connelly in Requiem for a Dream. He's like really feeling this abject despair. I mean, he's shot his own cuckolding, which is pretty low. And the way that he's framed here, looking like Jennifer Connelly, you know, it's not just that he's crying in the shower, which is usually something that happens if you've just had like a miscarriage in a melodramatic movie or something like that. But he just looks kind of like slight and womanly, which just makes him seem like even more of a beta male under the circumstances. It's all very well observed. So then he is ready to get the fuck out of Dodge. He takes his keys, gets in the van. You know, we'll see how they finish this picture without me. If you leave the camera behind, it'll probably fare just fine.
They'll probably figure it out.
So he's pulling on out, and his headlights fall upon the old woman, and he gets out thinking that she's confused, and he tries to usher her out of the road and back to her home, and she makes a pass at him, and he's repulsed, and then she stabs him in the throat repeatedly. He goes down, and she just keeps laying into him. Earlier, when he was arguing with Lorraine, talking about how you can't just introduce a new character partway through the movie. You can't just change direction like that. She's like, well, Psycho's one of your favorite movies. And then he gets
goes all proto-Reddit on her.
Yeah, he deploys the word MacGuffin.
Like, well, before, it was in that movie, the plot is MacGuffin to get... We're not doing that.
Yeah, so here he kind of gets the Janet Leigh death. And not just because he just had a shower scene. It's the one that comes a little bit out of left field. It's more prepared for here than in Psycho. Also, obviously, I mean, nothing is going to be the shower scene ever again. So it's not even worth pointing out that it doesn't have the same impact. But blood has been spilled, and now we're in a horror movie. We have switched gears in the way that he was describing during that argument. Like, it's okay when Hitchcock did it, because that was a horror movie. Well, this is also a horror movie, Chief. You know, so down you go. Lorraine wakes up. RJ is nowhere to be seen. RJ? She enlists Wayne?
Yeah.
She enlists Wayne's help. And he's just wearing nothing but his briefs. And he's like, hail and tarnation. All right, I'll help you look for him. And so he starts hoofing it around the homestead, wearing practically nothing, and steps on a rusty nail in a barn and starts hobbling around on his bleeding foot, and hears some creaking or other commotion behind a wall, peers through it, and
there's three circular holes close to each other, and we see there's a lot of back and forth, like, oh, we can see light through it. Oh, it's covered over. So somebody's there, and he's trying to figure out who it is. And before he can, he gets two out of three of the tines of a pitchfork into his eyes.
Yeah. And it's set up like it's going to be a Fulci thing, like zombie. Yeah. And it very much is. When the pitchfork comes out, at least one of his eyeballs comes with it, which is rather nice. Let's see. Lorraine goes up to the house proper. The man of the house is up and about.
Have you seen my wife? She gets confused.
So he enlists her to go looking with him.
There's a flashlight in the basement.
He sends her down to retrieve it. She does, and then she comes back up the stairs, and the door has been bolted. So she's trapped in the basement. Old lady covers up Wayne's body with an amount of straw. Not enough to conceal a corpse. You know, she just kind of puts a modest pile of straw on his torso. The perfect crime, I guess. You could just hear the sheriff and his deputy going, oh, obviously he stepped on a nail and then fell forward. Into a pitchfork. And then he
crawled under the hay to die. Like a dog.
That's how we do it down here in Texas.
So while she's quite incompetently disposing of that body, we find another body with Lorraine down in the basement. There's a guy strung up who looks like he's been there for a little while. So this makes the old lady's killing spree a little easier for me to digest, because I thought that when she killed the director that she had just finally snapped and this was her first offense. But they done been killing folks at Chateau Leatherface, and the man is also in on it. So, all right, not their first rodeo. The man of the house, the old man, goes to the place where the hippie porno stars are staying, and he recruits Jackson, who, it's funny, every man who comes to the rescue in this movie is wearing less clothes than the one who preceded him. Jackson comes out buck-ass nude with his, in silhouette, somewhat
big
demurely.
Green and buck-ass nude.
But, you know, his silhouetted porno dick is hanging down practically past his knees. And the old man doesn't comment on this. He's looking for his wife. And the two of them are both veterans of two world wars and Vietnam, in Jackson's case. And the two of them set off into the woods. And sure enough, as soon as Jackson is alone, there's one shot in particular where he's like walking through the trees that looks like he's back in, you know, you expect CCR to start playing. You know, it looks like he's back in the shit.
Or Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah,
maybe.
Right. So he sees a flashlight in the gator water and goes to nab it, thinking that either the old man or maybe his wife has fallen in. I thought for sure he was going to be gator food, but he makes it out. He has another talk with the old man. They'd bonded moments ago about being veterans and how they were treating this like a combat deployment. You know, right. Jackson was very confident that with his Green Beret training or whatever, he would find her in no time. And old man starts talking about how, you know, the last, I don't remember what he calls him, Bohemian, maybe.
The last Bohemians who came around this way were just like you. Flaunting their goods,
strutting about,
strutting their stuff, seducing my wife.
Well, it wasn't seducing, but it's like riling up my wife or
something. Yeah,
and we've already had one conversation between man and wife where basically it's like, well, we can't fuck anymore because I don't want to have a heart attack.
Right.
That's kind of his rationale.
Yeah, his ticker is not what it used to be, so her needs are not being met.
This culminates with the old man giving Jackson both barrels of the shotgun.
Yeah.
Incidentally, Jackson also on his walk through.
Oh, yes. Speaking of Psycho, this is, you know, the most explicit. He finds a car half submerged in muck.
Looks like an old Beetle.
Yeah. It reminded me very much of the car disposal scene from Psycho, where you're rooting for Norman to get away with it because it's just so anxiety producing.
So all of the men are dead now. All of the male porn actors/crew.
Yeah, and none of the women. And that should feel more conspicuous than it is. Somehow, and I was struck by it around this point, like all three of the women are still just fine. Well, one of them is being held captive in the basement, but the other two are asleep. You know, they're none the wiser. And that it doesn't feel somehow like Ty West is playing favorites, even though it ought to, which I thought was well played. But now the women start dropping like flies. Blondie, what was her name? She has two names.
Bobby Lynn,
thank you. Bobby Lynn goes first. She wakes up. Well, there's screaming, and there's screaming because Maxine wakes up. Why does Maxine wake up, you ask? Because the old lady, covered in blood, has taken off her nightgown and crawled into bed with her.
And has been caressing her.
Yes. I thought for sure this movie was going to end with the old lady wearing Maxine's skin. I mean, she fondles it so often and clearly cherishes it. You know, is constantly talking about it. I was like you once, you know, and too true. More on that later.
It also occurred to me, it's not out of the realm of possibility that there's going to be some, like, vampire shit that
right.
happens where the old lady drains the life out of her and then looks like her.
I thought maybe, you ever see Skeleton Twins? That's that fucking Bill Hader movie.
Ew, Kristen Wiig.
Skeleton Key.
I have not.
Okay, I thought that it was going maybe in a Skeleton Key direction, and I won't, I guess, spoil the nature of that supernatural twist for your sake. Although I know of one viewer in particular who was psychologically traumatized by that movie at a young age. One listener, I should say. Not a visual medium is podcasting.
Tell that to fucking Rogan.
There's plenty of things I would tell Joe Rogan if I had my druthers.
Probably not in the top 50.
So after being awoken by screaming, the woman has just wandered off, the old woman. And so now it's Maxine and Bobby Lynn. Maxine goes into the bathroom to furiously scrub herself. And we don't even see her scrubbing off blood. She just seems so disgusted by the old woman's touch that she wants to just
cleanse herself.
Scrub herself clean. Meanwhile, Bobby Lynn goes outside, finds the old lady shivering naked on the end of the dock where earlier Maxine had taken her little dip. So already we sense where this is going. Bobby Lynn takes off her coat or shawl or whatever she's wearing, drapes it around the old lady, and tells her some kind words or some would-be kind words about how, you know, she looked after her nan when she started losing her marbles. I thought about being a nurse, believe it or not. This draws the old lady's ire.
I don't need a nurse,
bitch. And they get into it. Some less kind words are exchanged, and then the old lady pushes Bobby Lynn into the gator soup. And the
gator doesn't take his time this time.
No, he makes short work of her. I saw an interview. No, not an interview. It was an episode of Trailers from Hell with Ty West once, where he was introducing Temple of Doom. And he talked about how it's his favorite Indiana Jones movie, or the one that made the biggest impression on him when he was a kid, and how to him it was always just a true blue horror movie. And I think the gator attack here is the fruits of that seed.
Sure. Meanwhile, Lorraine, this might have been a little while ago now, but we're cutting back and forth a lot. She has secured a hatchet from the old man's toolbox down in the basement. And so she's trying to break out of the basement door, and she punches out one of its sections, and she's trying to pull the bolts free so she can get out. And unfortunately, she doesn't do this quick enough, partly because she started on the wrong fucking side of the door. And I don't mean locked behind it, but like left to right. It's the wrong side.
She's opposite the bolt. So yeah. She has to kind of scrabble for it.
Yeah.
Grope around blindly for it.
The old man shows up and starts just bashing her hand and pretty well mutilating it with, I guess, the butt of the shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, stay in there. So she does, while still crying out for help.
Husband and wife rendezvous in the guest house and have leathery, decrepit sex in one of the beds there under which Maxine is hiding. So they're going at it for the first time in centuries, effectively. And it seems euphoric for both of them, the woman especially. Maxine makes good her escape while they're in flagrante whatever. And
Delicto,
thank you. And
Klaatu Barada Nikta.
Yeah, right. I'd always turn into Bruce Campbell when I not yeah, when I try to say that phrase. It's like in flagrante. So Maxine gets to the van. I think the keys are missing. In any case, she hears screaming from the house, so even if the keys had been there, she probably would have done the right thing. Maybe not. But she, in any case, she grabs a pistol from the glove compartment, which was alluded to earlier when the old man had Wayne at gunpoint.
Yeah, afterwards, he's like, it ain't even loaded. Usually you just have to wave it at somebody and it'll do the trick. And Wayne says something like, oh, yeah, I got the same thing in my glove box. And we had actually seen the pistol briefly beforehand. So file that away. That gun is probably not loaded.
Mm-hmm. So Maxine rescues Lorraine. Lorraine freaks the fuck out and starts screaming, I hate you. I hate all of you, in such a way that, you know, it's not just that she's cracking under the pressure, but she's, I guess, supposed to be rejecting the whole libertine lifestyle right. that she was briefly seduced into. Mama always warned me that if I did to shot a porno flick, I'd be...
Mama told me not to come. So she runs out the front door and immediately gets a face full of shotgun.
Yeah, so for all her final girl vibes, she is actually the penultimate girl. As it turns out, her final girl qualities do not avail her. And I, at this point, I kind of suspected that would be the case because Maxine and the old woman have a kinship of a kind. The old woman seems to think that she's the special one. She's mentioned this more than once, you know, I don't like blondes. She says this after she feeds the one woman to the alligators.
Yeah.
She's only got eyes for Maxine. So the elderly ne'er-do-wells come back to their house.
They're dragging Lorraine's corpse inside.
Right, I wouldn't want to lie to this. This is pretty funny. They're dragging Lorraine inside, who has taken the shotgun shell to the face, looking pretty well chewed up. And old man says, oh, she's heavier than she looks. And then Lorraine coughs or sputters. Yeah, she's not quite dead yet. And this fatally jump scares the old man. His ticker promptly gives out and he slumps against the wall and his head droops onto his chest. Old lady is distraught. I'm glad that the two of them got to have one last roll in the hay before he, because that's the main thing that she was craving.
Right.
So now Maxine reveals herself. She's got the old lady at gunpoint, got the drop on her. The gun, of course, is not loaded. We learn this after they have an exchange that is kind of like what Lorraine was rambling about when she was released from her captivity. Their exchange is also sort of dripping with import. You know, again, the old lady starts in with the "we're not so different, you and I" kind of mustache twirling villain monologue.
"I'm nothing like you," says Maxine. "I'm going to be a star someday." Click, click.
And then the old lady trains the shotgun on her, pulls the trigger, and goes flying out through the doorway. She just gets recoiled
20 feet back, like she's in a Walter Hill film.
Yeah.
And Maxine has, fortunately, the old lady doesn't move that fast, so when she's bringing the gun up, Maxine has the good sense to duck, and she manages to completely avoid injury.
Well, the other thing that kind of slathers import all over this scene is that the preacher on the tube in the next room is once again talking his Old Testament spiel about the sinful ways of Sodom and Gomorrah and the world's going to hell in a handbasket.
And at one point he says something. And
he starts parroting them, or they start parroting him. It's really kind of strange.
No, it makes sense, and we'll get to why in a second. But one of her mantras is, "I refuse to accept a life I do not deserve." I believe that's exactly it. And he says that word for word on the TV. He's gotten, like, from his fire and brimstone segment to his empowerment through Christ segment, I guess. So he's more upbeat now. And so I was like, "Oh, that's weird. You know, why are they both saying the same thing?"
No, you're right. That is contextualized in due order.
Yeah. So Maxine goes outside and she's heading for the truck. The old lady's saying all manner of,
"I've fallen and I can't get up."
Well, first that, you know, "please help me." And then when Maxine is having none of it and just gets in the truck, old lady starts spewing bile, you know, like, "you're going to end up old and withered like me, and you fucking bitch. And
it'll all get taken away from you."
And she's crawling forward and to the point where I'm like, "you don't want to keep crawling. You don't like where that's going," because it puts her directly in the path of the pickup truck if it shifts into reverse. And
which
sure enough, Maxine backs directly over her skull.
Yeah, and quickly, her broken hip is the least of her worries. Like, quickly enough, she has no worries anymore.
Ever again.
None whatsoever. And at one point she does say, "my hip," which is a little funny, and not just because, you know, haha, she's an old lady, but specifically earlier in the movie, her husband, when he was recruiting
Jackson
to help go look for her, he says, you know, "if she should fall, you know, I'm
break her hip."
Yeah, right, he says that exactly. So it feels like almost karmic that that's exactly what becomes of her. And then her head gets splatted like a melon. Maxine is taking off down the road. We got sunrise coming over the trees, and she is still talking in sort of preacher mode, which I did not care for, but it then does make a good deal more sense.
We cut back. Oh, it's in the next scene?
I think so. I think it's the following day. I think it's when the sheriffs are mopping up.
Okay. So exit Maxine, and we're back to the opening. The sheriff and his deputy are kind of wandering around looking at stuff. We see the preacher on the TV again. Fucking marathon session, or it's just getting replayed, I guess. He says, "Now, I want to talk to you about something. Hey, come up here, get a shot of this." And he, like, pulls back a cloth, very dramatic reveal, covering up a picture of Maxine, as it turns out.
"This is my daughter,
my lovely
Maxine,
daughter,
who's drawn from our home by devils and, you know, all
the
this
pleasures
stuff
of the flesh."
So I was like, oh, so she got all this stuff from her dad. I guess that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Well, the camera pushes in on the tube while this is happening, and the way that the preacher, if you've seen The Sacrament, you know that Ty West has a flair for charismatic preachers, you know, and their whole hustle. I mean, the Jim Jones guy, whoever they got to play the Jim Jones analog in The Sacrament, fucking killed it. And the preacher in this movie is good, too. The way he says, "come here, take a look at this." You expect him to pull off the tarp and for there to be, you know, like a mutilated corpse or something. You know, you expect it to be some kind of macabre ninth inning twist where, like, the whole town is, like, full of maniacs or something. But it's a much more modest reveal. It's just
about TCM again.
Yeah, right. Okay, this is Maxine's background. Okay.
Yeah. And the film proper closes with another deputy coming up to the first and, to the sheriff holding the camera from the chute and saying, found this in the whatever, and what do you think's on it? And the sheriff says, I don't know. I'll tell you one thing. One fucked up horror movie.
But yeah, right, exactly. Based on the bodies and the carnage. One fucked up horror movie.
And cut immediately. Smash cut to credits.
Yeah, written, directed, produced.
and fucking listening to Robert Palmer, Doctor.
Yeah. I gotta say, it's a good movie. It's not fucked up enough to end on quite such a self-congratulatory note.
Sure.
There needed to be one more layer of perversity or one, like, bravura moment of just balls-to-the-wall horror in order to really earn that last line, I think. Particularly because the frame narrative, you know, the mother of God moment, that's presumably them reacting to the body of the bohemian who was strung up in the basement with Lorraine.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not even one of the characters who kicks the bucket in the film that we're watching, you know, that's just like preamble. So that feels like a broken promise a little bit, you know, when he says my God and then it cuts to an alive and intact Maxine, I feel like there's an implicit promise being made there that like this alive woman, you know,
will be a dead woman.
Yeah. And like you can subvert that expectation. You can have her get away at the end. That nonetheless, that's the expectation you're setting up. And I think it's at least a mistake to not have one of her friends and compatriots be the one who's eliciting that reaction from the sheriff. I think it's a little bit of a dud to have that just be somebody else, some an earlier notch on the old crazy couple's bedpost. A little anticlimactic.
Then we get a post-credit sequence, which basically flashes back 60 years to the old lady back when she was young, and chaos ensues. It's a very kind of
Grindhousey. Yeah, it reminded me of one of the interstitial trailers from Grindhouse. Yeah. Very much so. It's for a movie called Pearl, which
is the old lady's name.
I kind of hope Ty West goes on to make Pearl. Is played in 1918. By the same actress who played Maxine. And I kind of wish, I think with the reveal about her being the preacher's daughter, this would have muddied the water a little too much, but I wish that some of that Pearl material had been in this movie, because it would have made it feel a little more substantial, potentially. Would have made the old lady a little less of a one-note kind of Norma Desmond nymphomaniac. But
sure.
But more on that, I'm sure, after the break.
I want to be in the movie.
Well, you can't.
The story can't just change midway through.
If Daddy catches us, there's no telling what he might do.
My wife is not well. It happens after dark.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/Shock Doctors Pod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Maxine? That woman was in my bed touching me! You don't want to leave, do you?
People's eyes are going to pop out of their damn skulls when they see this.
And we're back. So we kind of buried the lead a little bit. Matt said just before we went into the break that in the Pearl pseudo trailer post credits scene, the actress who played Maxine is playing Pearl, but I'm pretty sure, in fact I'm basically certain, that she also plays Pearl as an old lady in the main film.
That escaped my notice. I thought that it might be a younger actress made up to look 106, but right. I wasn't sure it was that actress specifically.
No, there's just, there was a little too much. There's like some resemblance there, and she sounded a little bit similar, obviously, you know, like, but still the basic timbre of the voice was reminiscent. And I mean, I can confirm it right now, but I am almost.
No, gut check. That seems right. I would be very taken aback if that were not the case.
And that's, as tricky double role stunt casting goes, that's a pretty neat trick.
Yeah, I mean, that's conceptually, I mean, it's pulled off invisibly enough that I was not even distracted by it. I mean, like I said, it escaped my notice, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it shouldn't feel like a stunt in the moment, or at least not like a distracting one. I do wish that some of the young Pearl stuff had been incorporated into the film proper in one form or another, because it looks, based on the grindhousey trailer that we're given after the credits roll, it looks like there's more than enough there to furnish a whole horror movie, and indeed that's the way it's being pitched. So you don't have to get into all of that. Like, at one point it looks like she maybe tips her dad into the gator pond. Some old man in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Might be a grandfather, or who knows. But it looks like a sort of turn of the century, like a hush hush Sweet Charlotte kind of thing,
right?
Which I'm all about. And I don't know, I just think every time old Pearl opens her mouth, it's variations on a theme. You know, I was beautiful once, I had what you had, we're so much alike, you and I. And the movie just, it revels so much in her decrepitude, and that sort of thing doesn't ordinarily bother me, whether it's Relic or Taking of Deborah Logan.
Deborah Logan was definitely the vibe I was even like the nature of the makeup kind of makes her look like the actress who played Deborah Logan looks in that movie.
Yeah, with the wispy white hair
and just the general shape of the face and so on. And so it was very reminiscent of Deborah Logan.
And mercifully, you know, she is not as batty as the old lady in, say, The Visit, where it's just
nor does she turn into an unhinged jaw snake eating someone like the third act of Deborah Logan.
Right, so she's not caricatured to the same extent. I mean, you've got the Fleetwood Mac scene that's supposed to make you feel for her, and I suppose it does to a certain extent, but nonetheless, all the way through, her physical existence is just, it's like, I don't know, the movie just kind of wallows in her elderliness and unattractiveness in a way that kind of, I mean, it didn't necessarily bother me on like moral or artistic grounds. It just didn't land, you know. So I kept thinking, like, it was specifically when she was putting the moves on the camera guy and he acts like she popped a zit in his face or something. And I was like, oh, bleh, you know, and I just thought, yeah, man, Harold and Maude's not a horror movie. You know, it's not a scary concept. It might be a little unsavory, but I wasn't feeling the kind of bone deep revulsion that maybe I was supposed to feel. But conversely, I also wasn't on the old lady's side, because she just goes so berserk that, I don't know. I kept expecting, here's maybe what it boils down to. I kept wondering all the way through the buildup, which is exquisite. I think Ty West kind of has a problem with endings historically, at least for me. But the run-up to the climax is always just like pitch perfect. House of the Devil in particular is a movie that's like 90% buildup.
Right.
Just terrific tension all the way through. And then the ending is good, but not great. And is the only thing that's not operating at like a really masterful level in that movie, as far as I'm concerned. Sacrament also kind of loses its way in the third act. I called it Jonestown Jr. at the top of the episode, because he clearly didn't just have the budget or the resources to do actual Jonestown numbers.
Right.
It's just like you see like a couple dozen people die. It's like, nah, that doesn't cut the mustard.
That ain't me.
And here, too, I think the ending was a little bit of a letdown, and partly because all the way through the buildup portion, which was my favorite part of this movie, I kept thinking, all right, so where is the actual peril going to come from? Where is the physical menace going to come from? Because it can't just be these two old biddies. They've got to have like an inbred deformed nephew who lives under the floorboards or something. And they just don't. I mean, it is actually just the two of them. And, you know, all the kills make sense. The two of them never do anything superhuman. It's not like The Visit where they, like, channeled the chupacabra every once in a while. and they certainly don't turn into python people like Deborah Logan did. But it really is just this sort of old-ass, natural-born killers kind of thing at the end of the day. And it was all just a little bit thinner than I expected it to be. On the basis of the trailer, which is, I remember being assembled in such a way that you really don't know what you're in for. I mean, I thought, there's a line in the trailer, what's in the movie too, where the old man says something like, "She gets this way after dark." It's like, is this movie about werewolves? Like, what does she turn into? It could have been anything. And until like halfway through the movie, there was still kind of that feeling of possibility and potential. Like, this could go a lot of different ways. And then the way that it went, the movie just kind of narrowed a little bit in a way that I didn't find wholly satisfying. I think partly because I wasn't feeling either the kind of disgust or the kind of pity that I think I would have had to feel to get really exercised one way or the other about this old lady and her murder rampage.
Yeah,
Well, it's just like when they go to bed with each other, the husband and wife, you know, they reach out and touch each other and it's like rubbing dry leaves together. You know, like the movie is so at pains to impress upon you how vile they both are. And, you know, I like body horror. You know, I'm scared of getting old. I just turned 31 like a couple days ago. So that all has worked for me in the past and I'm sure will again. There was just something about it this time around that was, I don't know, a little too eager. It was just striving for an ickiness that I just didn't see.
Well, and I remarked on this when we were watching it. It just seemed like every single time they cut back to her, she somehow looked older.
Yeah, it was like she drank from the wrong grail. It was like aging rapidly before our eyes.
Poorly. Yeah, it's just a little bit much. I know you said the closing line fell a little flat for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't disagree with your rationale, but it also didn't bother me as much because I just took it to be kind of emblematic of the whole grindhouse thing that he was kind of going for. It's just like, oh, this is the over-the-top closing line that this movie would have had in the 70s.
Well, it brings it full circle in terms of the, you know, sheriff, you're going to want to come take a look at this.
Right, exactly. And so from that point of view, it didn't really bother me so much. But you're right, I mean, it isn't quite one real fucked up horror movie.
Yeah,
it's a well executed kind of fucked up horror movie.
Well, and if they had pushed the porno stuff a little further, there's one shot of Bobby Lynn, is that her name?
Yeah,
where I think she's like wiping cum off her back.
Yes.
she's like, and she like tosses a cum rag out of frame and it lands at a
Lorraine's knees.
Oops, sorry, darling. You know, and so like that's like a little hardcore, but just generally, if they'd gone, and maybe there'll be like a DVD or something where they'll release the X-rated cut or whatever, but if there had just been some Lars von Trier style, like hardcore insert shots here and there, then I think you could have, what I'm saying is you could have ramped up the sex half of the picture and kept the horror stuff exactly the same, and then the sheriff's last line wouldn't have bothered me, because then the movie would have been fucked up in a sense, or more of an envelope pusher in a different way.
Right.
And it would have been more outré one way or another, and I would have been fine with that. But, you know, as far as horror movies go, it's fairly middle of the road.
Yeah.
Content wise, I mean, in terms of the craft, it's better than average, at least especially for the buildup, which, as I said, is pretty exquisite. It does that thing that you got in some of the best horror movies of the 70s, and I'll say this, it's a good palate cleanser after that cosmically dreadful, artistically bankrupt Texas Chainsaw requel from a little while ago. One thing that the original Texas Chainsaw does that I harped on about ad nauseum, I'm sure, in that episode, so I won't regurgitate it, is that feeling of the whole world just spinning out of control and being this shambolic mess in which horrible things happen routinely and there's no rhyme or reason to it, and we're all just teetering on the brink of some terrible gulf that's gonna swallow us up, you know, on and on and on. It's just like this kind of nihilism. There's a little bit of that in this movie. You know, you get it like a you get it for a fraction of a second as they're driving into the middle of nowhere. They're looking for tunes on the radio, and they go past a speech by probably President Carter or somebody. I just heard you just hear a fragment of a, you know, the world needs peace. It could have been the preacher, I guess, but it, you know, it sounded like a politician.
Right.
But more so, you get it in this kind of just hazy, abstract way where, you know, it's like when Maxine is swimming, she's skinny dipping, first of all, so that's in keeping with the porno stylings,
goddamn,
I guess.
Bohemians.
Yeah, right. And the gator starts bearing down on her. You know, it's a total non sequitur, and I guess it's planting that gets paid off when Bobby Lynn bites the dust. The crocodile's presence in the water has been established. But in the moment, you're just cutting between Maxine getting menaced by a gator and the porno scene, the dialogue scene. No, the daddy thing comes later. Well, I think maybe it's just
the fucking scene.
I think it is just the fucking scene. But for some reason, the daddy's coming home, that whole bit. Both of these scenes, the cross-cutting is just really effective. And I am hard-pressed to even say why. This alligator should be, it should feel like filler. It should feel like a move of desperation that, you know, there's not enough happening, so let's sick a gator on one of the characters. But it works because in that moment, the tension is such that it feels like something is just holistically wrong. That, you know, like anywhere these characters go, misfortune is going to befall them, whether it's an alligator or, you know, if she'd, rather than taking a dip in the lake, had instead wandered into the barn, she would have almost fallen into a grain thresher or something like that. You know, it doesn't really matter. The world is just out to get them in that classic 70s Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of way, where it's almost like a 70s Watergate paranoia, like it's a conspiracy and the world wants to see you dead. You know, the
well,
everything is arrayed against you. Even the alligators are in on it. I like that atmosphere very much. And he doesn't sustain it all the way through, Ty West. Like I said, I think endings are not always his strong suit. And I haven't seen In a Valley of Violence, so maybe I should hold my tongue. But then again, that's, you know, a different genre, so the same problems, the same rules don't necessarily apply. But for much of the first half of this movie, even the first two-thirds of this movie, I was really very pleased.
Yeah, I agree with you there. One thing we didn't mention, actually, in the gator scene is that the old lady, Pearl, is visible.
Yes.
Back in the trees.
Out of focus, right, moving behind the limbs of the trees, the trunks of the trees, and that's quite spooky.
Yeah, and Maxine never turns around to see her there. But
yeah, she never sees her or the alligator. She's between a rock and a hard place, and she notices neither.
Yeah, so that sort of feeds into what you're saying about the whole world being arrayed against them to the point where it's almost like Pearl and the gator are in it together.
Yes.
Like, all right, gator buddy, spring the trap.
Well, and well, they might be I don't think alligators are capable of that much loyalty. You know, it's not like they're doing tricks at SeaWorld. but
right.
You know, if she has been feeding them hepcats and, you know, beatniks and, you know, just people, young people, then yeah, it's possible that they're conspirators in a sense.
Yeah.
I know you have no great love for Eaten Alive. That Toby Hooper movie, but I haven't seen it, so I can't speak on that. But that could also be
people do get fed to gators a lot. that movie's so bad. Toby Hooper is the weirdest motherfucker
because
he's got like one stone cold brilliant classic.
Yeah,
he's got The Funhouse and Life Force.
Poltergeist, which a lot of people just lay at Spielberg's feet. You know?
Frankly, I buy that based on what Poltergeist is like, to a large extent.
I buy it up to a point.
Yeah.
I think there's a Spielbergian element in Hooper's filmmaking, at least in Texas Chainsaw. There are moments in Texas Chainsaw Massacre that look like they came straight out of Amblin, you know, like, which is not like what comes to your mind first when you think of Spielberg, even though he named his production company after it.
Right.
But I think that the two of them have a little more in common than people sometimes give them credit for. But obviously, all of the suburban nuclear family stuff in Poltergeist is much more Spielberg's milieu than Hooper's.
But anyway, so...
And I haven't seen The Funhouse or Eaten Alive. They're both on my to-do list.
Right. At least The Funhouse and Life Force, both movies I enjoyed, Life Force especially, but they're like not of the same caliber. And then he's also made really shitty movies like Eaten Alive. I know you just said it's on your radar. I can't recommend it to you.
No.
It's kind of a mess.
Too bad.
But yeah, weird filmography, that guy.
I like, you know, even though it doesn't get as hardcore as I'd like, and it doesn't push the porno aspect as far as I might have liked, although I'm not necessarily expecting to see that in a multiplex theater in the year of our Lord 2022, you know.
Although I did see a tweet, somebody's like, we need more cum in horror movies. Like, okay, I guess,
hey.
if you want. I mean, why is that your benchmark?
I guess I don't know. Maybe Ty West saw Green Knight and was like, okay, challenge accepted. David Lowery laid down the gauntlet.
Yeah, but David Lowery still wins that battle. Things shook out in X. Fucking A.
So a little bit of timidity on the porno front, notwithstanding. I like all of that. I think that the way that it's intercut with the rest of the action is really pretty sensational. And, you know, I just like the whole Boogie Nights era on display here. I like the 70s attire. You know, the one actress, Maxine, spends like half the movie walking around in a pair of overalls. That's like it's just a masterpiece of side boob. It's like really within a millimeter of a wardrobe malfunction.
Right.
And it's just, you know, it's just that kind of playful, teasing sort of 70s porno aesthetic where it's still cheerful. It's before William H. Macy blows his brains out at the midpoint of Boogie Nights. It's before everything goes to shit.
Right. Before people are doing too much coke.
Yes.
They're doing just the right amount of coke.
Now, I talked before about the Watergate atmosphere, the conspiratorial kind of energy that suffuses a lot of my favorite, I mean, sometimes literally cult horror movies from the 70s. You know, if you're talking about Wicker Man, for example, obviously there's cult shenanigans at play there. But it's implicit even in some movies from that era where it often goes unremarked upon. Like in The Exorcist, there's never explicit confirmation that there's a Satanist presence in Georgetown, but like somebody defaced that church. We never find out who. It probably wasn't Reagan. Probably wasn't Linda Blair.
Probably not.
Crawling out of bed in the dead of night, you know? So there's just sort of a witchy feeling of, you know, and in Texas Chainsaw, too, all of the weird animal bone totems that they have hanging around Chateau Leatherface. It's sort of a pagan idolatry kind of thing. It's like, what is their whole spiritual situation? You know, I'd like to know what is their alignment? What are they worshiping back here in the ass end of nowhere? And that kind of compounds the creep factor for me in a big way. And this movie generates a certain amount of that, and some of that might be projection on my part because that's a quality that I look for in 70s horror movies, and this movie evokes that period so successfully that maybe I was looking for something that just wasn't there and was never gonna be. However, but that's also probably the reason I was half expecting, half hoping for the preacher to yank off that tarp at the end and see, you know, a woman with her mouth sewn shut or something like that. Some kind of like Kevin Smith Red State kind of thing where like he butchers a person live on stage. The blood of the lamb or like some shit like that. I haven't even seen Red State, but you get the idea. That feeling where everybody's in on it. That just doesn't, it is just the two of them at the end of the day, the old lady and the old man, and it creates a certain thinness, a certain narrowness. Now, I wish, well, for a couple reasons. One, I think it would have been more cruel for Maxine to drive off and leave the old lady crawling through the dirt with her broken hip just to die of exposure, I guess, or just to, who knows. The way that she backs up over the head, you know, and it gooshes, that is good grindhouse fun, but it's, I don't know, a little, this is a weird thing to say about a movie that's basically 20% of the way to being a porno, but it's like a little tawdrier than what it seemed like the movie was angling for with their pseudo spiritual connection, the two of them, the old lady, Pearl, I guess, yeah. Pearl and Maxine, for her to just go out like, who's the fucking guy? Who's Frank Vincent? In
Phil
Soprano.
Leotardo.
Phil Leotardo, yeah. For her to just go out like Phil Leotardo at the end of the day. I don't know, that didn't quite... It's not just that I wanted the two of them to have some kind of more meaningful something or other, because that never really gelled for me. But more to the point, I think they could have done something creepy. Something creepy could have happened if the old lady was still dragging her carcass around when Maxine took off into the night. Then, you know, so the sheriffs could have arrived on the scene the following day and found something we weren't expecting. You know, if the old lady had, even if she just crawled back into her husband's arms, there's all sorts of things that she could have done in her dying moments that would have created a more effective send-off than just seeing her get Phil Leotardo'd. I mean, she could have... I said before that I half expected her, sort of hoped that she would wind up carving off a younger woman's skin and and wearing it. Something like that, you know, like, mother of God, you know, like, have him be reacting to that. Something grisly that isn't just last week's victim hung up to dry. You know, something that we haven't seen. An ace that the movie has kept up its sleeve. The movie just doesn't have that ace in the hole that I wanted it to have. And if they had come through the door and seen the old lady maybe still just barely clinging to life, covered in blood, trying to assemble a nubile young girl suit or something, then if the sheriff had come out and said, "One fucked up horror movie," I would have been like, "Fuck yeah. That's, you know, damn right it is. You the man, Ty West." Instead, I was just kind of grumpy. And, you know, some of that grumpiness has to do with my feeling that he just never quite sticks the landing, although there's no doubt in my mind that he's got a masterpiece in him. I mean, House of the Devil is very close to that caliber, I think. His filmmaking is just top-notch much of the time. I like the soundtrack very much, as I said before. There's a moment, I think it's when Maxine is skinny-dipping, when the camera pulls out. I think it's like a bird's eye view situation. And the camera either zooms in or zooms out in such a way it's in tandem with one of the, like, the exhalations on the soundtrack, that it's almost like the movie itself is respirating. It creates this feeling, you know, the camera movement and the soundtrack. It's just sort of dreamy. Really good stuff all around.
I think I'm thinking of the same shot you're talking about. It's before she gets in, where she just walks to the end of the dock. And it does a zoom out.
Uh-huh.
And that, more than anything else, is like, oh, this is from the 70s.
Yes.
I have been transported
into
a cinema in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
I am there now.
Yes. Oh, hey, there was a lot of that in House of the Devil. And
yeah, a little bit lighter touch of that in this movie. But that shot in particular is very much like the stuff he does in House of the Devil, evoking the 70s.
Well, and he's done his homework, because, you know, so many horror movies would do that and it would just seem kind of clunky, or you would see what it was striving for, but it would be just a pastiche. Whereas here, it looks like it's just cut from that same cloth. It's that time machine feeling that you were describing. I think he has a way of moving his camera laterally a little bit while also zooming out, like, slow enough that the camera's moving in a way that's kind of disorienting and almost sloppy, but there's still a steady hand behind it. And that feels like dirty, kind of boots on the ground 70s independent filmmaking, or even studio filmmaking, you know, when it was just a little bit more freewheeling. I can't put into words exactly how he does it. I would have to have it in front of me, but it's usually that the camera's doing more than one thing at a time.
Well, and it's the polar opposite of the, like, robot eye calibration zoom that you get in, like, a J.J. Abrams thing.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's, when I say polar opposite, I mean that quite literally. Like, it could not be any more distinct from that.
Yes, it doesn't feel mechanical. It feels kind of loosey-goosey.
Which is how most cinematography in the 70s looks.
Right.
Because it had to.
Yes.
Didn't have fucking digital zoom and steady cam shit going on all the time.
Well, yeah, and I like faster zooms and more precise zooms too. If you're Stanley Kubrick or something, you know, if it's like Red Rum, boom, like zooming in on the mirror and then on Shelley Duvall's face, or there's all kinds of great, very quick zooms in The Shining that do feel like they've been,
but those
administered by a robot.
Well, but not quite. To me, those feel, they're precise in a sense because it's Kubrick and he's a fucking perfectionist, infamously.
Yes.
I mean, this is not me being a film dork. This is me having read anything about Kubrick
MacGuffin.
You're a MacGuffin. But there's also something very human about it in that it feels almost like the camera is rushing very orderly, but still sort of pell-mell at something, again, as opposed to a J.J. Abrams where it's just like a robot eye like zooming in and centering on it.
Or the Kubrick zoom, the quick ones in The Shining anyway. He does slow zooms also, a lot of them in Barry Lyndon, which give it kind of a painterly quality, like you're at a museum and you're like moving closer to a painting mounted on the wall across the room from you. But in The Shining, the quick zooms convey panic or like sudden realizations, like, oh my God.
Right.
Murder. Red Room. Whereas when J.J. Abrams or Zack Snyder does it to keep track of an X-Wing or Superman, falling out of the sky, it feels like you're getting closer as quickly as possible just in the name of efficiency and just for strictly utilitarian reasons. Like it's just kind of telescopic. It's like, oh, let's get us right up to where the action is. And there isn't really a feeling so much motivating that. It's more just getting you closer to the spectacle, which is by no means a bad thing, but I find those shots irksome for some reason, and I have for several years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was ranting and raving before about how the just depiction of elderliness, and I feel like I've talked about this before on the podcast, how horror movies that depict the horror of aging do so with varying degrees of tact, and some of them rub me the wrong way, some of them don't bother me, they bother me to varying degrees, the ones that do bother me. This one bothered me, as I said, only because it was just so gung-ho about the perversity of two octogenarians getting their bone on, that it was just so repellent. Or Maxine gets touched by the old lady and has like a Lady Macbeth breakdown where she's, practically scrubbing the skin off her bones afterwards. And it is, the old lady was groping her in her sleep. That is a violation. I don't necessarily blame Maxine for reacting that way, but everything to do with the old woman's sexuality is just treated like she's an aphid or something. Like she's just she's a slug or a nest of spiders. It's presented as totally monstrous in a way that I kind of didn't care for. Now, I was reminded while I was having that reaction sitting there in the theater of a movie that I saw once. That's from 75. It's called Criminally Insane, although you might also know it as Crazy Fat Ethel. it's a horror movie, sort of a horror comedy, I guess, given its premise. It's about a woman, an overweight woman, who I think has just been released from a sanitarium, and she's been entrusted to an aunt, or maybe it's her mother. I remember it being like an older woman, legal guardian of some kind, because she can't be expected to care for herself. And she has a binge eating disorder where she'll just eat you out of house and home. This is the way it's talked about by all the men in white coats. So Ethel is released from the loony bin and finds that now the fridge has a lock on it and all the cupboards are locked up. And she naturally doesn't have any of the keys. And so she starts going stir crazy and eventually just starts murdering everyone who is impeding her progress towards eating to her heart's content. And that's her whole MO. So I learned about this movie from a TikTok that was ragging on it and railing against it for being problematic. This movie called Crazy Fat Ethel about this obese woman who's just slicing and dicing people so that she can eat as many Toblerones as she wants or whatever. And the TikToker, naturally, was talking about how distasteful this was and how crass and sexist and fatphobic and so on. And I heard all of that, and I didn't even disagree with it, but there was a more profound part of me that thought, I have to watch this immediately. I have to track this movie down and get it into my eyeballs because it sounds like a blast. And it's good. You know, it's not really good in the conventional sense, but I enjoyed it. And I think that what X tries to do with the landslide sequence and at various points is to make you feel sorry for Pearl. And it doesn't necessarily pull that off. I thought actually that, and it might just be because I've always been a chunky dude, I thought that Ethel was a much more sympathetic character because it's not like she just goes totally berserk and starts lopping off heads, you know, like a Chris Farley character or something, you know, is rampaging around. She, I think it's more of a domino effect situation where she kills her caretaker during an altercation that is food motivated, that she wants access to the cupboards or the fridge, and there's a struggle and somebody dies, and then all of the other murders are sort of a consequence of that, where it's, you know, people start sniffing around and asking too many questions, and it's almost more of a to call it like a noir kind of a plot would be way overselling it, but it's, you know, it's not like she's just in this food frenzy that turns her into a great white shark, you know, just like a mindless killing machine. You do sort of feel for crazy fat Ethel. At least I did. More so than I did, it has to be said, than I did for Pearl. And I'm grateful to that TikTok, you know, even if its editorial slant was a little different than mine might have been, for introducing me to that particular flick. And I do recommend it, believe it or not. I think it's generally known under the title Criminally Insane, which is probably for the best. The poster is exactly as sleazy as you're imagining. She's like wielding a bloody meat cleaver. Got it right in front of me. The tagline is 250 pounds of maniacal fury. Poster definitely makes it out. And, you know, you got Ethel front and center glaring at you. And, you know, so the poster definitely makes it out to be the kind of movie that I'm trying to claim that it isn't. And it's possible that I didn't watch it that long ago, but, you know, with certain horror movies from that era, I can get rose-tinted glasses some of the time. So, as always, your mileage may vary, maybe with this recommendation even more so than usual, but I enjoyed Criminally Insane from 1975, and I think it does the thing that X tries to do, which is take the lady killer who's othered in a way that is just kind of innately problematic, whether it's fear of the elderly or fear of the fat. But I think that, incredibly, a movie that is known to some as Crazy Fat Ethel does that with a little bit more, well, I hesitate to say nuance, but, you know, a little bit, well, and sensitivity also very much is not the right word.
The pathos is a little more successful.
For me, it was, yes.
Fair enough. The movie I'm going to recommend, we rattled off much of Ty West's filmography earlier on in the episode, but one that we didn't mention in the film that I am going to recommend is The Innkeepers.
Oh, yeah, I forgot he did that one.
It's about a pair of employees at I think it's somewhere like New England-y, but it's sort of a basically abandoned hotel.
Yeah.
In an area that isn't really a tourist destination anymore.
Or it might be like the off season or something like that.
Well, I think it's like both maybe. Like the hotel has seen better days, and also it's the off season. And like I think the hotel may be on the verge of closing down for good.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, these two employees are there, and they're the only ones there, at least at first. And very solid bump in the night kind of stuff goes on. Eventually, they are joined by a human living guest who also knows a little bit about ghosts. And so they kind of try and suss out exactly what's going on. It's very low-key, so it's quite different from X.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of his most conventional movie, at least that I've seen. It's almost like if Ty West did like a James Wan script. But it is more, it's dialed way back from that. It doesn't have the third act that you'd get in a James Wan movie where you get into the further and it just goes completely off the rails.
Yeah, for a ghost story it is profoundly grounded.
Yes.
And I think that's to its credit. So check out The Innkeepers and check out Crazy Fat Ethel. And X. X is a good time. X playing at theaters near you. Nobody was in our screening today, and it just came out like 4 days ago. So it certainly deserves better than that. We encourage you to go out and check out X in the theater. But for now, I think...
Or catch it on DVD and catch, you know, all of those hardcore porno
that
inserts.
Deep dicking.
That I trust Ty West is going to splice in there if he knows what's
good
for him. All the cum shots.
Kid Cudi going to Pound Town.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kid Cudi plays Jackson, incidentally. We didn't mention that, but there you go. Well, I think we're going to put this one fucked up horror movie back in the can for now.
Mm-hmm.
So until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from X Official Trailer HD A24, uploaded by A24. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, April 10th, and we will be discussing Uma, a film about intergenerational violence and the hardships of the immigrant experience. See you then.